Welcome. My name is William Shiro. I'm a professor of political studies in North Pacific languages in the Language, Languages, and Cultures Department at UCLA. I'm also the moderator.
Sorry, I can't hear you.
Yeah.
That's okay. I just introduced myself, and I'm not important to this. I'd like to welcome you to the third talk in the 2017 Bible and its Interpreters lecture series. It's sponsored by the Alan D. Levy Center for Jewish Studies and co-sponsored by my department, the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures, as well as the Department of History. Welcome here. I want to thank especially all the staff at the center for all the work they do in organizing these lectures. Today we're fortunate to have Professor Lauren Monroe, who's an associate professor in the Department of Near Eastern Studies at Cornell University. Dr. Monroe received her PhD in Bible and Ancient Near East from New York University, and her research spans Hebrew and Judaic studies, Syro-Palestinian archaeology, ancient Israelite religious and social history, and she has also studied the roles of women in ancient Israel, and how they've been developed in later Jewish and Christian thought. Professor Monroe has brought Cornell students with her to excavate a variety of different excavations in Israel, including Tel Zayit, Tel Rehov, Abel Maaka. Her book, Josiah's Reform and the Dynamics of Defilement, Israelite Rites of Violence and the Making of the Biblical Text, was published by Oxford University Press in 2011. And in the book, she explored 7th century BC religious reforms in the Judean king Josiah, whose rites of violence are a formative moment in the Bible's representation in the emergence of monotheism. She's currently working on a monograph on the emergence of the Bible's Joseph's traditions, and we're going to hear a little bit about that today. And she also has a very interesting large-scale research project entitled Tidings from Sheba, which addresses how South Arabian Sabaean inscriptions from Yemen illuminate ancient Israelite society, politics, and religion. So hopefully you'll face that in a few years, and we'll bring you back again to talk about that project. Please join me in giving Dr. Monroe a warm welcome.
Is this working? Is that on? I don't know. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. Thank you, Professor Schneedelin, for the introduction and for the invitation. It's such a pleasure to be here, my first time at UCLA. So thank you. I also want to thank the Center for Jewish Studies for the invitation and coordinating my visit. The name Joseph appears in the Bible in two distinct contexts. The first is as one of the two youngest sons of Jacob by his wife Rachel in the saga that occupies the end of the book of Genesis. This Joseph is incorporated into a 12-tribe vision of Jacob as Israel, in which Joseph is but one element. But as a single member of a larger collective, Joseph stands out as distinct among his brothers, first for the sheer space allotted to him in the book of Genesis, far more than any other of Jacob's progeny. In addition, he's the only son whose bones travel with the Israelites in their departure from Egypt to Canaan. He appears to be the youngest son of Jacob in Genesis 37, but in other contexts is the eldest of Rachel's two boys. Within the 12-tribe territorial vision of Israel that is set forth in the book of Joshua and that dominates biblical tradition, Joseph is equated with Ephraim and Manasseh, two sons born to him by his Egyptian wife Asnat, according to Genesis 41:51-52. The incorporation of Ephraim and Manasseh into the family of Jacob, as if they were his own sons, puts Joseph in an awkward position vis-a-vis the 12-tribe system to which he ostensibly belongs. He stands at a distance, replaced in effect by his sons, so not quite a tribe like his brothers, while at the same time he's positioned so as to receive a double inheritance in the central highlands of Canaan, no less, that is, in the very heartland of Israel. In addition to use of the name Joseph in the origin stories of Genesis and Joshua, The name Joseph, or Beit Yosef, also appears as a designation for a political entity, most frequently the Northern Kingdom. Yet as with Joseph of Genesis, here too we find certain tensions and inconsistencies. The name Beit Yosef is attested 8 times and only in Nevi'im. In Joshua 17, Judges 1, 2 Samuel 19, 1 Kings 11, Amos 5, Zechariah 10, and Obadiah 1. In most of these instances, the term signifies the Northern Kingdom as a territorial counterpart to Judah. For example, in Zechariah 10:6, the prophet assures, "I will give victory to Beit Yehuda and triumph to Beit Yosef." Similarly, Joshua 18:5 presents a bipartite division in which Judah shall remain by its territory in the south, and the house of Joseph shall remain by its territory in the north. Obadiah pairs Beit Yaakov, here a designation for Judah, and Beit Yosef as counterparts that together will defeat Beit Edom. In a prophecy against the house of Israel, Amos 5 inveighs, "Seek Yahweh and you will live, else he will rush like fire upon Beit Yosef and consume Bethel with none to quench it." Judges 1 likewise associates the Beit Yosef with Bethel, again here in contradistinction to Judah. With one notable exception, which I shall discuss shortly, unlike the B'nai Yosef, or sons of Joseph, the Beit Yosef is never identified with Ephraim and Manasseh. Nor, for that matter, does it appear to be tied to the tradition of Jacob and his sons that provides a genealogical basis for the territorial schema set forth in Joshua. This suggests that conceptually the Beit Yosef stands at a distance from these received traditions, while at the same time the shared name suggests a connection. My talk this afternoon will focus on how best to understand the relationship between Joseph of Genesis and the Beit Yosef. I will begin with the latter, focusing on references to the Beit Yosef in 2 Samuel 19, 1 Kings 11, and Judges 1, 3 texts where the term cannot possibly signify the Northern Kingdom as such. These, I will argue, offer some perspective on the identity of this entity as a feature of both biblical literature and of Israel's socio-political landscape in the pre- and early monarchic period. From here, I will move on to a literary historical analysis of the Joseph story itself, suggesting that embedded in this iconic narrative is an older, self-contained, rags-to-riches story of Joseph the Hebrew, who rises to the rank of second in command over all of Egypt, and who has no connection to Jacob or brothers in Canaan. When this core material is considered in light of the Beit Yosef traditions, a portrait of the Israelite ancestor emerges that is deeply rooted in non-Davidic, pre-Omride Israel, an elusive phase in Israel's past from both the standpoint of texts and archaeology. To further anticipate my conclusions, I will suggest that certain features of the Beit Yosef, as they are preserved in the Bible, map well onto the geopolitical landscape of the late Bronze Age Levant, as revealed especially in the 14th century Egyptian Amarna archive. When the relevant biblical texts are considered in light of the Amarna evidence, the Beit Yosef comes into focus as an Iron Age vestige of the late Bronze Age system of Egyptian administrative control in the region. I do not mean to suggest that the texts that preserve these Beit Yosef traditions originate in this period, or even that the authors of these texts necessarily understood the term's earlier significance. Rather, by incorporating and reorienting older traditions, the received biblical narratives inadvertently provide access to a set of associations for the name Beit Yosef that are different from its use to connote Israel or the Northern Kingdom in later periods. The idea that the Beit Yosef was deeply tied to Egypt finds support in the identification of an older core to the Joseph story itself, that features a Yahweh-worshipping eponymous ancestor who rises to a position of great power in the Egyptian court. This tradition was likewise reoriented in the service of a later narrative that incorporated Joseph into the family of Jacob, or Israel. The name Israel appears famously for the first time in the Egyptian Merenta stele of the late 13th century, and then not again until the 9th century Tel Dan and Mesha inscriptions, as well as in the Assyrian annals of Shalmaneser III. The intervening 300-year history in which Israel went from a small feature in the Levantine landscape to a full-fledged monarchy is poorly understood and obscured rather than illuminated by the broad strokes of biblical narrative. In a pair of forthcoming articles, Dan Fleming and I attempt to fill out some of this picture by tracing a transition the Bible preserves from what we refer to as Little Israel, situated primarily in the central highlands of Canaan, in the territory associated in Joshua with the tribes of Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin, to a greater Israel that stretched north of the Jezreel Valley and east of the Jordan River. The present work on Joseph is an outgrowth of that project and part of my own book in progress entitled Joseph the Hebrew and the Genesis of Ancient Israel, in which I offer a comprehensive treatment of the Bible's multi-layered and multivalent Joseph traditions as a window on the intersection of literary and socio-political processes at work in the formation of the Bible and ancient Israel. In this project, I'm drawn to instances in which familiar terms, for example, the name Joseph itself, are used to signify what is unfamiliar or antithetical to larger scale conceptual frameworks or narrative interests. When we encounter instances of this double signification, it is an invitation to prick up our ears to the supple whisper of subterranean voices, to seek out soft spots in the hardened surface of received texts. Pressing on them moves us deeper into the past, not into history, but towards it. Ultimately, my interest lies in how to access something of the socio-political realities that shaped earliest Israel from biblical texts given their received form by scribes working many centuries later. It is my sense that the Bible's Beit Yosef traditions provide one point of access. 2 Samuel 16 recounts the story of a certain Benjaminite Saul loyalist by the name of Shimei ben Gera, who appears before David, cursing him for having seized the throne of Saul. In 2 Samuel 19, after the death of Absalom, as preparations are being made to escort David back across the Jordan, Shimei hurries to meet the king, flings himself before him, and begs his forgiveness. In verses 20 and 21, he pleads, "Do not think of me, my lord, as guilty, and do not remember the wrong your servant committed on the day my lord the king set forth from Jerusalem, that the king should take it to heart. For your servant knows that I have sinned. See, I have come today the first of the entire house of Joseph, Rishon Lechol Beit Yosef, to come down to meet my lord the king." Given the setting of this narrative in the early days of the monarchy, it is impossible to understand this reference to the Beit Yosef in terms of a northern kingdom as such, even as a concept imposed anachronistically. One might take Beit Yosef as a reference to Ephraim and Manasseh, that is, to the Joseph tribes, as these are defined in Joshua's tribal territorial lists. However, Shimei's identification as Ben HaYemini Asher MeBachurim, literally of the Yemini who are from Bachurim, suggests that Shimei's tribal identity is not defined in the text either in terms of Ephraim and Manasseh, or for that matter, by way of Joseph. His identification with the Beit Yosef is a secondary affiliation, separate from his tribal identity. Furthermore, as mentioned a moment ago, with one exception, unlike the B'nai Yosef, the Beit Yosef is never associated with Ephraim and Manasseh. The exception appears in Joshua 17:17, where reference to these tribal names is likely to be a gloss in the Masoretic text, intended to mitigate the unusual identification of the Beit Yosef as an Am Rav, a great or mighty people, a designation that is unexpected in reference to a single named group in Joshua's schematic allotment of tribal territories. By explaining that by Beit Yosef, the authors really mean Ephraim and Manasseh, the glossator in effect harmonizes the Beit Yosef to the B'nai Yosef mentioned earlier in the passage, resolving an inconsistency in the text and forging an equivalency that is not in fact supported by the distribution of references to Beit Yosef elsewhere in the biblical corpus. MacArthur suggests that we are to think of Shimei's reference to the Beit Yosef as signifying all of the northern tribes, in contrast to the house of Judah. This would be consistent with the use of the Beit Yosef terminology elsewhere in the Bible. However, this explanation does not account for many of the details in the narrative, including the fact that Beit Yehuda plays no role. It is worth noting that implicit in the idea of Beit Yosef as a reference to the northern tribes is that the northern tribes were capable of collective political action in a time before the establishment of the northern kingdom, a point that McCarter does not address. There's nothing inherently problematic about this. In fact, it is a picture that aligns with Fleming's model of collective Israel. However, within the larger Samuel narrative, Israel's choice of David has already been confirmed in 2 Samuel 5 by the elders' treaty and anointment of him at Hebron. Shimei's accusations against David in 2 Samuel 16 and his reference to himself as the first of the house of Joseph suggests that he represents a different political constituency. Taking the text at face value, the Beit Yosef here seems to connote a substantial recognized collective, I might even say an Amrav, to use the language of Joshua 17, to which Shimei of the Yemini belongs. The importance of the Beit Yosef in ratifying Israel's kingship may be intimated in David's rhetorical exclamation in 1923, "Should a man of Israel die today, Hayom Yumat Ish B'Yisrael, for do I not know that today I am king over Israel? Ki Hayom Ani Melech B'Yisrael." The structure of this verse suggests a change in status for both David and Shimei. Through Shimei's public acceptance of David, not only does David become Melech B'Yisrael, but Shimei becomes Ish B'Yisrael. That is, Shimei's identification as part of Israel is directly tied to his acceptance of David's rule. This may be significant for trying to understand the relationship between Israel and the Beit Yosef. However these two entities were connected to one another, it is Israel that's ruled. A second reference to the Beit Yosef appears in 1 Kings 11:28. Here, in recognition of Jeroboam ben Nevat's capability as a worker, Solomon appoints him over all the forced labor of the house of Joseph, who Yifkodo told the whole Sevel Beit Yosef. Kogan takes this as a reference to compulsory state service, the mas ascribed to Solomon in 1 Kings 5:27, and goes on to say that if the state corvée was organized on the basis of the 12-district system, as were the other taxes, then the term House of Joseph refers to the district of Mount Ephraim referred to in 1 Kings 4:8, not to the dispersed Joseph tribes as a whole. Like the glossator in Joshua 17, Kogan here assumes a false equivalency between the Beit Yosef and B'nai Yosef, allowing him to connect the Beit Yosef of 1 Kings 11 to Har Ephraim of 1 Kings 4, though this equation is never made by the biblical authors. Furthermore, he treats the mas of 1 Kings 5 as equivalent to the sevel of 1 Kings 11. The mas is forced labor, and sevel means something similar, corvée or forced labor. Assuming that both refer to the imposition of Solomon's administrative apparatus, a reading that biblical usage does not support. The closest parallel to the phrase sevel Beit Yosef, the forced labor of the house of Joseph, may be found in Exodus 6:6-7, where God promises to bring Israel out from under Savlot Mitzrayim, the burdens of Egypt. Based on this, the implication of 1 Kings 11 is not that the Beit Yosef was oppressed. Rather, it was in a position of dominance, imposing, not bearing, Kol Sevel. If this seems odd, we need only think of Joseph himself in Genesis 41, whom Pharaoh places over all Egypt, Vayetze Yosef al Eretz Mitzrayim, and Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. That this is an expression of dominance is often missed in translations of the identical expression in Psalm 81:6. He imposed it as a decree upon Joseph, but Seto al Eretz Mitzrayim. Translators tend to render either when he went forth from the land of Egypt, for example, the JPS translation, which brings the verse into alignment with the Exodus tradition, or when he went out against Egypt, which is in the NIV as well as Hosfeld and Zenger. While this translation is technically better, it maintains the notion of an adversarial relationship to Egypt that is in fact at odds with the Joseph story itself, where Joseph is fully integrated into and in a position of power within the Egyptian bureaucracy. I will return to Genesis 41 later on. The point for the moment is that when Solomon appoints Jeroboam over Sevel Beit Yosef, Jeroboam assumes leadership of an entity that already held a position of dominance in the land. The representation of Jeroboam as assuming control of the Beit Yosef pertains to and foreshadows the transfer of power from Solomon to Jeroboam. The verse is concerned with something altogether different than references to taxes and state-mandated labor imposed by Solomon in 1 Kings 4 to 5. Much as the Beit Yosef in 2 Samuel 19 was essential in legitimating David's rule over and against Saul's, here it bestows legitimacy upon Jeroboam, just as Solomon is about to fall from grace. There may, in fact, be an implicit critique of Solomon that an ancient audience would have been attuned to in his placement of control of this particular entity in someone else's hands. Jeroboam's acceptance of this responsibility would have been the first step in ratifying his own authority over the Israel he would come to rule. Another instance of the Beit Yosef in a position of dominance, here in a pre-monarchic setting, appears in Judges 1, 34 to 35. Here, after a list of towns that the Israelite tribes failed to dispossess, Lo Horish, we find this notice. The Amorites pressed the B'nai Dan toward the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down into the valley. The Amorites undertook to settle in Har Heres, Ayalon, and Sha'albim, but the hand of the Beit Yosef was heavy, and they became a forced labor. The B'nai Dan are treated here as separate from the tribal groups named in the preceding Lo Horish list. By relegating the Amorites to the status of mas, or forced labor, the Beit Yosef comes to the aid of the B'nai Dan against the territorial ambitions of the Amorites. Though Judges 1 is widely regarded as a late Judahite reintroduction to the book of Judges, I would suggest that reference to the imposition of mas on the Amorites by the Beit Yosef in verses 34 to 35 may preserve the memory of an old pre-monarchic geopolitics. The dynamics and language of Judges 1, 34 to 35 may have informed the presentation of the Lo Horish list in the preceding verses, and in particular, repetition of the Haya Lamas formula. The Beit Yosef of Judges 1, 34 to 35 is presented as an entity that pre-existed the establishment of the monarchy and could exercise its political will in cooperation with or opposition to other groups. In this case, it acts in cooperation with the B'nai Dan against the Amorites. It appears to be in a position to police the interactions between these two groups and to dominate in the Shephelah lowlands. Though we receive this tradition filtered through the hands of late Judahite authors and editors, and it is difficult to know how place names and interactions might have been modified to reflect later interests, the encounter between the Amorites and the B'nai Dan and the Beit Yosef may be illuminated by letters in the Amarna archive sent between Egypt's vassals and dependents scattered throughout Syria-Palestine and the Egyptian king. In a recent monograph, Brendan Benz offers a reassessment of the socio-political categories attested in the Amarna archive. He demonstrates that in the late Bronze and Iron I periods, the landscape of the southern Levant was characterized by a wide variety of socio-political experiences that included cities with political will executed by a single leader, or Khazanu, centralized lands characterized by a high degree of centralization under an administrative complex located in a single urban center under the authority of a single individual, and multi-polity decentralized lands comprised of a political coalition of cities and centralized lands that retained their independence under the authority of their respective leaders. Some multi-polity decentralized lands were inimical to Egypt and its interests, as in the case of Amuru, while others, most notably Canaan, consisted of entities that aligned themselves politically with Egyptian interests. Ben suggests that the multi-polity decentralized land is the most appropriate category for understanding the kingdom of Labayu, which included Shechem, and which is the primary focus of his study, as well as Israel's political organization before the formation of the monarchy. Implicit in this idea is that patterns that were established in the context of late Bronze Age Egyptian hegemony continued to shape the socio-political landscape of Syria-Palestine in the centuries after Egyptian power had waned. The Beit Yosef, as it is attested especially in Judges 1:34-35, but also in 2 Samuel 19 and 1 Kings 11, may best be understood in light of this political category. Several of Benz's observations are noteworthy in this regard. First, he observes that because the constituents of such entities retained their independence, this form of organization provided for some level of political unity without threatening locally embedded sources of identity and authority. This might help to explain Shimei's self-identification as both Ben Hayimini Asher Mebachurim, his tribal and town identity, and Rishon L'chol Beit Yosef, the first of the entire house of Joseph, to come down to meet the king. Shimei's tribal and town identity are in no way eclipsed by or at odds with his association with the Beit Yosef. Rather, as a Benjaminite from Bahurim, he represents only one element within the multi-polity collective called the Beit Yosef. That he is a Benjaminite and Saul loyalist might have made his constituency's endorsement particularly important in the transfer of power from Saul to David. Second, Benz notes that though the authors of the Amarna letters were often consumed by military concerns, the multi-polity decentralized land did not exist solely for mutual protection against a common enemy, but also for other non-martial corporate activities such as agricultural production. In support of this, he cites EA 365, in which Beridia, the Chazanu of Megiddo, and member of the multi-polity decentralized land of Gina, issues a complaint that he alone has furnished the necessary corvée workers to cultivate land around Shunama. He accuses the other Chazanuti of not doing the same. This text is on the handout. Naaman identifies Gina as the name by which the entire Jezreel Valley was known during the 18th dynasty in Egypt. And Moran identifies Shunama as biblical Shunem. Implicit in this letter is the idea that all of the members of the multi-polity decentralized land to which Beridia belonged were responsible for providing corvée labor for the cultivation of lands under Egyptian control. Beridia and his constituency are both aligned with and actively involved in the administration of these Egyptian interests. Reference to corvée labor in this letter is designated by the Akkadian masu, cognate to the Hebrew term mas, imposed on the Amorites by the Beit Yosef in Judges 1:34-35. The idea that the administration of corvée labor was one of the expectations of a multi-polity decentralized land might help to explain the expression Kol Sevel Beit Yosef, all the forced labor of the house of Joseph, in 1 Kings 11. On analogy with the corvée of EA 365, Sevel Beit Yosef would connote labor forces administered by the Beit Yosef, control of which now fell to Jeroboam. If there is merit to the idea that the Beit Yosef in these texts constitutes an entity that somehow continued to occupy a space in the socio-political landscape of Syria-Palestine in the wake of Egyptian domination, Jeroboam's flight directly to the Egyptian king Shishak in 1 Kings 11:40 and his residency in Egypt until the death of Solomon takes on greater significance. Jeroboam's association with and oversight of the Beit Yosef might have tied him to Egypt, easing movement between his base in Shechem and the pharaonic court. If this is the case, it would mean that though the weight of Egyptian hegemony in the region had lessened, some of the infrastructure remained, represented at least in part by the Beit Yosef. This limited continuity between late Bronze Age and Iron Age and the Iron Age in Syria-Palestine might offer some additional perspective on the late 10th century campaign against Palestine of Pharaoh Shishak I, that is biblical Shishak, depicted in both the Book of Kings and on the walls of the Temple of Amun in Thebes. Israel Finkelstein's designation New Canaan to describe continuity with the preceding period in the material culture of 11th century lowland settlements is relevant here, as are references to dwellers in Canaan, Yoshvei Kanaan, and kings of Canaan, Malchei Kanaan, in the old poetry of Exodus 15:15 and Judges 5:19. With these observations in mind, in the time that remains, I will turn my attention to another Yahweh-worshipping refugee in Pharaoh's court, Joseph himself. I shall suggest that underlying the story of Joseph ben Jacob, if you will, is a yet earlier version of the Joseph story, concentrated primarily in Genesis 39 to 41, which features Joseph alone with no brothers and no explicit connection to Canaan, other than his identification as an Ivri in the land of Egypt. This self-contained rags-to-riches story of a Hebrew servant who rises to the rank of second in command to Pharaoh constitutes the oldest material in the Joseph story, I think. The literary priority of Joseph the Hebrew to the larger account of Joseph ben Jacob and the incorporation of the former into the latter point to a different, arguably earlier social horizon for the Joseph the Hebrew story. I will suggest that this older Joseph tale may provide us with an eponymous ancestor of the Beit Yosef, with its possible connections to Egypt and position of dominance in the pre- and early monarchic landscape of ancient Israel. In pursuing the idea that Genesis 39 to 41 constitutes an independent Joseph story that predates and inspired the composition of the larger narrative, I echo some of the conclusions of George Coates in his 1973 study, who considered this material the original kernel of the Joseph story. Coates is not alone in regarding these chapters as an independent unit that was either added to a pre-existent Joseph story as a digression, or constitutes some of the earliest material within the Joseph complex. However, as far as I can tell, he is alone in viewing these chapters as completely independent of the introductory material in Genesis 37, where we first meet Joseph and his brothers. He therefore provides the closest precedent for the reconstruction offered here. While my work pursues an interpretive path already forged by Coates, it offers a new perspective on the significance and socio-historical processes that underlie the composition, inclusion, and expansion of this early material. So I'm about to talk about the incorporation of this Joseph, the Hebrew story, into the larger Joseph story of Jacob and his brothers. And on the handout are Genesis 39 to 41 and 47. I didn't reproduce the entire Joseph story because I'm not really going to be talking about those intervening chapters. Genesis 39:2 through 41:54a, and some of 47 verses 14 to 23, and these are all marked in brackets on the handout, constitute a self-contained story of a certain Hebrew by the name of Joseph, whose rare combination of wit, good fortune, and divine inspiration led him from servitude in his Egyptian master's house to a position as overseer of the whole land of Egypt. These three chapters teem with people, nameless courtiers of the Pharaoh, who serve as foils for Joseph's ascent. The story opens with a prologue that begins in 39:2. Vayehi Adonai et Yosef, vayehi ish matzliach, vayehi bevet Adonav hamitzri. Yahweh was with Joseph. He was a successful man. He lived in the house of his Egyptian master. And ends in 39:6. Vayehi Yosef yafeh to'ar v'yafeh mar'eh. Joseph was beautiful in form and appearance, a detail that sets up the advances by his master's wife in 39:7 and following. Joseph's master takes a liking to him precisely because Yahweh was with him, which is explicit in 39:3-4, and puts Joseph in charge of his household, placing all that he owns in Joseph's hands. When Joseph is falsely accused of raping his master's wife and lands in prison, Yahweh remains with him, so that the chief jailer extends him kindness and leaves all of the prisoners in his capable hands. The appointment of Joseph over households and people is a leitmotif in this self-contained story, in which he effectively and systematically replaces the Egyptians in power. Nowhere in Genesis 39 to 41 is Joseph the Ivri explicitly identified with family or origins in Canaan. The absence of reference to Canaan in these chapters may be contrasted with Genesis 42 to 49, where Eretz Canaan appears repeatedly, occurring five times in Genesis 42 alone, precisely at the point where the old Joseph the Hebrew tale rejoins the story of Jacob and his sons. Here there may be an element of over-communication, or the lady doth protest too much, intended to reinforce Joseph's otherwise tenuous Canaanite roots. There are other details in Genesis 39 to 41 that set it apart from the surrounding narrative. For example, there is no reference to herding as Joseph's mode of economic subsistence, a characterization that's essential to Genesis 37 and the larger Jacob narrative. Genesis 39 refers to Joseph's master. However, the name Potiphar appears to be an invention of the scribes who produced chapter 37. As such, it provides a necessary bridge between the world occupied by Joseph's brothers in Canaan and the household in Egypt where Joseph is a servant. Reference to Potiphar in 39:1 echoes the conclusion of chapter 37, where he purchases Joseph from the Midianite traders in Egypt. Together, these two references bracket the insertion of the Judah and Tamar story in Genesis 38. The Joseph the Hebrew story thus begins in earnest in 39:2. Genesis 42:6 identifies Joseph as Shalit, or vizier. This term is absent from the account of his rise to power in 39-41, where he is placed over his master's house, the jailhouse, the house of Pharaoh, and finally over all of the land of Egypt, all expressed by the preposition all, to be over. I noticed on the flight over here when I was reading Professor Schniedewin's most recent book that he identifies this feature this is a feature of Hebrew, to be all something, or to be over something as a way of communicating authority or governance even. And he contrasts this with the Kanaano-Akkadian, or what he's calling Kanaano-Akkadian, which uses Shaknu as governor or high official. And it's interesting to me, and this is all, I'm sort of thinking, this is very recent thinking, but the use of the expression the one who is over is also a feature of Egyptian. So it's in Hebrew and it's in Egyptian, but it's not in Akkadian. And its repeated use in the Joseph the Hebrew story, I wonder whether it reflects a common Kanaano-Egyptian language of administration. So I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts about that. Finally, while Genesis 39 to 41 cast Joseph in an entirely positive light, as one whose divinely granted wisdom and discernment warranted his appointment as second in command of all of Egypt, his brothers' incredulity upon hearing his dreams, their chiding, and his father's rebuke call his elect status into question. This diminishing of Joseph in chapter 37 may be part and parcel of a shift from Joseph as an independent ancestor who, with his own associations, to Joseph as a single brother among 12, again to accommodate a more expansive definition of Israel. The old Joseph alone story is revised by introduction, a mode of scribal intervention identified by Sarah Milstein in her work on the composition of the Book of Judges, so that Genesis 37, with its story of young Joseph the dreamer, becomes the new starting point for a narrative about how Israel, defined as the 12 sons of Jacob, came to reside in Egypt. This new introduction reorients the core Joseph story and conditions the way we read the revised account that follows. The story of Joseph ben Jacob that begins in Genesis 37 resumes in chapter 42. In order to incorporate a Canaan-based Jacob tradition into an extant Egypt-based Joseph tradition, verses 41, 56, and 57, and 47, 13, expand the famine to include not just Egypt, but all lands, including Canaan. So Genesis 41, 56, V'hara'av haya al kol p'nei ha'aretz, V'yechazak hara'av be'eretz Mitzrayim, and Genesis 47:13, Tala eretz Mitzrayim v'eretz Kana'an mipnei hara'av. These verses create brackets around and allow for the insertion of the dramatic saga of Joseph's reunion with his brothers in chapters 42 to 47. References to famine in Canaan are at odds with the details of Genesis 39 to 41 and 47:15 to 26. That indicate famine in Egypt alone. For example, when Joseph interprets Pharaoh's dreams in 41:29 to 30, he predicts 7 years of great abundance will be in all the land of Egypt, b'chol eretz Mitzrayim, followed by 7 years of famine when all the abundance in the land of Egypt will be forgotten. Similarly, in 47:15b, the Egyptians alone come to Joseph asking for bread. And when Joseph provisions the Egyptian people while concentrating all of Egypt's wealth in the hands of Pharaoh, there's no reference to the land of Canaan. which is referred to in verses 13 to 15. A remnant of the original conclusion of the Joseph the Hebrew story may be preserved in Genesis 47:25, where the Egyptians declare, "We have found favor in the eyes of our Lord and will be servants to Pharaoh." Nimtza chen be'enei Adoni v'hayinu avadim l'faro. This verse closes the narrative circuit that began in 39:4 with Joseph, who found favor in his master's eyes and served him. V'yimtza Yosef chen be'enav v'yisharet oto. With 47:25, the promise of Joseph as an ish matzliach is fulfilled, his journey from servant to master completed, his position of dominance established. At the same time as 47:25 may preserve traces of an original ending, taken as a whole, the pericope in 47:14-24 and 26 is unlikely to be original to either the old core tradition or the story of Joseph ben Jacob. These verses feature an entirely different Joseph from either the naive dreamer we meet in Genesis 37 or the wise and benevolent administrator who is the hero of 39-41, and are likely to constitute a late addition. Genesis 47 presents a Joseph who outfoxes the Egyptians, extracting from them their money, their land, and eventually their servitude. Whereas Genesis 41:47-48, Joseph provides for each city by storing up its grain. In Genesis 47, he sells rations that he has personally acquired, building up wealth in the hands of Pharaoh, taxing his people, and leaving them entirely dependent. The note in 47:26 that Joseph instituted a 1/5 tax and made this a land law in Egypt for everyone but the priest constitutes an odd ending to the dramatic tale that precedes it. Yet these verses share with Genesis 39-41 a Joseph who has no apparent connections to Canaan or to Jacob and his sons. Furthermore, as in Genesis 39-41, Joseph stands in a position of power over Egypt, acting in a royal administrative capacity, though here in a more explicit reversal of imperial domination. If indeed Genesis 47:14-24 constitute a later addition and new ending, it suggests that even after the integration of Joseph into the family of Jacob and the establishment of this more expanded narrative tradition, the idea of an independent Joseph the Hebrew still held currency, even if only as a symbol of Israelite resistance to imperial authority. Joseph's identity as an Ivri is crucial to understanding the interests of the authors who produced Genesis 39-41. Naaman notes that this designation often appears in the Bible in unfavorable contexts. With the integration of Joseph the Hebrew into the larger Joseph ben Jacob story, the identification of Joseph as an Ivri does come to connote alienation and dejection in Egypt. However, references to Joseph as an Ivri in Genesis 39-41 are entirely neutral, and this in itself may point to an earlier social horizon for the Joseph the Hebrew story. The origins of the term Ivri and its possible connection to the Apiru, known from the archives of Ugarit, Alalach, and Amarna, is a long-standing problem in biblical studies, with a copious literature. Fleming notes that while the Apiru provide no direct link to Israel as either vocabulary or social entity, several texts from the early second millennium, before the term Apiru became a fixed type, attest a verb that appears to be cognate with the noun without being simply denominative. The verb always has to do with departure from one's home to take up residence in a different place, especially a different political entity. In the two Mari letters Fleming cites, the verb is applied to an individual who has moved either to or from a town where he was a relative outsider. The Mari evidence includes two nouns derived from this root, a G participle, ab or apirum, one who leaves or moves away, and the noun ib or iprum, designating the mobile community of the Yemenite herdsmen at a distance. The second noun is much rarer, not evidently becoming part of the general regional terminology, but matching the word Ivri exactly. It's worthwhile to note that the identification of Joseph as an Ivri in Genesis 39-41 is consistent with attestations of the verbal root at Mari in its application to a single individual who has moved away from home and taken up residence elsewhere. It connotes mobility not defined by alienation or exile. Connections to the use of the term Ibram at Mari offer no basis for dating the Joseph the Hebrew tradition. However, they do point to an understanding of the term that is both natural to the Syro-Palestinian landscape and uncolored by notions of bondage or suffering that inform the Bible's larger narrative of Israel and Egypt. If I'm correct that Joseph the Hebrew is an ancestor of the Beit Yosef, his identification as an Ivri would have been essential, as it provides him with ties to both Egypt, where he's completely at home, and a home in another political arena. Joseph the Hebrew and Jeroboam would have had this in common, though the word Ivri is never used in reference to the would-be king. Tracing its origins to this Yahweh-worshipping Ivri, who rose to power in Egypt, would have provided the Beit Yosef with a myth of legitimation for its position of dominance in Canaan. In his discussion of multi-polity decentralized lands, Benz observes, in addition to its membership, which could change over time and according to one's perspective, its political organization could change as well. Under the right conditions, a multi-polity decentralized land could transform into a centralized land under the leadership of a single individual who administered the entire complex from his royal center. Shimei's acceptance of David's rule, as well as Jeroboam's appointment over the labor forces of the Beit Yosef, might preserve memories, however hazy, of integration of the Beit Yosef and Israel's rule by kings. The incorporation of the Joseph the Hebrew story into the larger story of Jacob and his sons likewise indicates a formative role for Joseph in the genesis of ancient Israel. Thank you. Shall I field questions? Yeah. Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
What is your opinion how it happened that all tribes of Jews were associated with sons of Israel, Jacob, but two? And Joseph received no tribe, but two of his sons received separate tribes. What do you think about this? How it might happen at that time?
Yeah, the question of Ephraim and Manasseh is one that I don't feel like I have a full handle on. I think the reference to the birth of Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, in Egypt in Genesis 41, I think is a late addition to that text. That is related to an effort to construct a 12-tribe collective. But there's also, I think, some evidence that the association of Ephraim and Manasseh with Joseph, the association with the regions associated with Ephraim and Manasseh with Joseph may go back to much earlier than that. So one of the things I'm struggling with in this project, and this is the first time that I'm presenting this material in public, and it really is reflects my effort to try to fit together and make sense of pieces that it feels to me should fit together, and I'm not sure I have it quite right yet. But one of the questions is, if I'm right that the Beit Yosef has some sort of political potency in this landscape of the emergence of Israel, of earliest Israel, what is its relationship to Israel exactly? And I made reference in the paper to this idea of Little Israel and Greater Israel that Dan Fleming and I are working on. And Little Israel, as we understand it, is the place where Israel appears to have emerged politically, which is really in the Central Highlands. And that is the territory associated with Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. So I think the connection between Joseph and those territorial regions goes back to something, or is somehow, I don't want to say original necessarily, but it's old, I think. But the idea of Ephraim and Manasseh having to be incorporated into a system of 12, I think, is something that the biblical authors are struggling with at a late stage. So I don't know if that helps to answer the question.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer.
I think you are doing a very important research.
Thank you.
Because the role of Joseph was underestimated in research literature.
That's my sense also, yeah. Go ahead.
So in a very loose way, which I promise I won't hold you to, could you somehow attach centuries or clusters of centuries to the various stages of the emergence of this story?
I knew I was going to get that question. I'm compelled by the idea of the story of Jacob and his sons as a product of the northern kingdom, so without Judah, but this runs counter to some ideas about the tribal system, right? That there's this idea that the tribal system is somehow at odds with monarchy, and I actually don't think that that's right. I think that the idea of tribal territories that are united under one name is a great way for monarchy to sort of establish its vision of itself. And I think there is good evidence for the development of that idea being tied to the Omrides, the Northern Kingdom, in some way. So I would put the existence of the Joseph, the Hebrew story, as an independent unit at some point earlier in time than that. Although, of course, we only have the tradition through the lens of late biblical authors and editors, so I'm really I'm not just hesitant. I'm sort of at a loss to know how to put it any more firmly than that, or I'd be afraid to at this point. But I would say that the tradition of Joseph the Hebrew is certainly pre-9th century. That the story, and as a written text, is pre-9th century. And that it's tied to this landscape that goes back even a little bit earlier than that. But it's tricky territory. Yeah.
Would you agree that the narrative purpose of Joseph's story is to connect up two independent narratives, the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob story of Genesis and the Moses story of Exodus?
Yeah, this is a good question. I'm not sure yet. I don't think I would put it that way, that it is sort of intended to be a bridge between these two narrative units, because I think that there are elements of the narrative that runs between Abraham all the way through Moses that are old. That I wouldn't think of a sort of narrative block of the Abraham, Isaac, and then the Jacob story, and then the Joseph story as a bridge. I think it's a little bit too monolithic to put it that way. One of the things that I'm interested in and I haven't pursued yet is the use of the name Ivri in the Moses story. And there are some things that Joseph and Moses have in common, like they both marry the daughters of priests, and they both are associated with the term Ivri, and there are a couple of other things that are escaping me right now. And so one of the things that I want to do is look more closely at what's going on in the Moses story and see whether there may be material in there that actually belongs with the Joseph the Hebrew material somehow. But one of the things that seems clear to me is that the Joseph the Hebrew story does not envision an exodus from Egypt. Nothing is impelling Joseph and his family out of Egypt. That really is introduced with the Moses story.
But what else gets the Israelites into Egypt?
Well, one of the things that I guess is an implication of what I'm suggesting is that one of the factors might be that there is this deeply embedded connection between the Beit Yosef and the story of Joseph in Egypt that becomes the kind of place from which the larger narrative springs. So, but that would probably just be one piece of what's going into the biblical representation of Israel in and out of Egypt. Yeah, there. Go ahead, Aaron.
Thanks for a fantastic presentation. I mean, I think it's a very compelling direction and research, and that there are probably a number of things outside of the biblical text to support that kind of focus on the northern part of the hill country. Can you clarify the point you were trying to make between the difference of B'nai Yosef and Beit Yosef again? Because I think I missed the subtlety.
Yeah, sure. With the exception of this one reference in Joshua 17:17 that's on the handout, the name Beit Yosef is never associated with Ephraim and Manasseh, whereas B'nai Yosef is. So that's part of what makes me think that the Beit Yosef is somehow not connected to these sort of genealogical notions of Israel as they play out in the biblical text, or it's operating in a different kind of arena.
So in that light, thinking of the Beit as more of an expression of political organization or ally relationship, might be more artificial than a kind of ancestral, although those can be fictive as well. Is there a way to localize power? I would ask it a different way. Do you see a relationship between the obvious candidate, Shechem, perhaps, in the northern hill country, and your Beit Yosef? Is there somewhere in the Bible where you get a connection to suggest that Shechem functions as the regional capital to this ally relationship?
Well, so I've been thinking, this is a question I've been thinking about, and don't have a fully worked out answer. I think Jeroboam's connection to Shechem is, you know, that's the obvious, the sort of immediately obvious thing to look at. The Beit Yosef is also in three places associated with Bethel. And I'm kind of on the fence about what to make of the Bethel references. I've had recent conversations with Mark Smith, who's working on a commentary on Judges, and his reading of Judges 1 and the association of the Beit Yosef to Bethel is that this is very late and reflects a kind of Persian period organization. Finkelstein and Singer Ovitz, in their reassessment of the archaeology at Bethel, I think really make it hard to imagine that Bethel would have been a place that was that important in the Persian period. I'm not sure what to do with that evidence. But there's some connection, definitely, between the Beit Yosef and Bethel that is more apparent than connections to Shechem, as far as I can see. But I think this thing with Jeroboam going from Shechem to Shishak is really provocative. And I need to look more at the Labayu correspondence that Brendan Benz has treated to get a better sense of what was going on there. Yeah?
Did the tradition of blessing male children in the name of Ephraim and Manasseh, excuse me, started medieval times or earlier, later? And what did the rabbi say about the choice, and does that enlighten your thesis?
I have no idea where that tradition comes from. It's really interesting, isn't it? That so this is the traditional blessing of the children on the Sabbath is in the name of Ephraim and Manasseh, the Yismichah Elohim, the Ephraim and Manasseh, right? Where that comes from, I don't know. I mean, it's coming from Jacob's blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh in the biblical account, but the idea that that gets highlighted and absorbed into the tradition in that really powerful way, I don't know when that comes in. Yeah?
So I appreciate your argument that Beit Yosef is not a genealogical person, and I appreciate the point that Ephraim and Manasseh, as sons of Joseph, might actually be a later installation, part of the establishment.
Specifically as sons, maybe, yeah.
But is it not possible to think of the Beit Yosef as reflecting the dominance of those communities over the overall backdrop of what became the Northern Kingdom? Such that it's not necessarily a non-geological category. It simply reflects the fact that these two entities, Ephraim and Manasseh, really are quite dominant against the larger backdrop of the communities that compose the Gulf. Hence, Shinny would refer to himself as a Benjamite that isn't totally forgotten, but it's the most important thing is that he belongs to this Beit Yosef. In a way, along the lines of how we very easily confuse the Netherlands with Holland is one part of the Netherlands, two parts, but by far the most important part, such that too easily get confused. such that Beit Yosef comes to stand for things that are actually technically outside of Beit Yosef.
I guess my tentativeness, so I think something like that may be going on, because I do think that the Beit Yosef and early Israel are emerging or are connected to one another in some way, and are that the interactions between the Beit Yosef and Israel are shaping the emergence of Israel as a polity, and that's happening within that Central Highlands territory associated with Ephraim and Manasseh. I guess, so on some level, I would agree with what you're saying. I think my tentativeness has to do with being unsure of how solid and secure those names are as a, what those names actually connote in the period that I'm talking about. And there are some biblical texts that make reference to Ephraim and Benjamin without Manasseh. Or the Song of Deborah refers to Ephraim. The battle takes place in the territory that's identified with Manasseh, but Manasseh is never mentioned. And it seems that Ephraim is a name that refers to the entire region that comes to include Manasseh. So I'm not sure how... I'm not so confident in the name Manasseh, particularly in the name Manasseh itself, as something that goes back to the period that I'm sort of thinking of this as happening within. But in terms of geography, I think what you're saying is probably right, although the text in Judges 1 is interesting because it's the Shephelah that the Beit Yosef is policing. So while I tend to think that what we're talking about is this kind of Central Highlands, Ephraim, Manasseh, Benjamin territory, I think that the nature of the Beit Yosef, as I'm beginning to understand it, might be that it extends beyond or isn't bounded by the kinds of territorial boundaries that we tend to associate with these tribal territories. Yeah.
One interesting and perhaps powerful artifact of the concept of Beit Yosef is in the Messianic myths of Judaism, because there are two messiahs, not one. One of the messiahs is the ultimate messiah, but it is the messiah from the house of Judah. But that doesn't happen unless there's a messiah from the house of Joseph, Beit Yosef. And that has vast implications about being able to have the first Messiah die in battle, but not the end of the Messiah.
Where are those texts that you're referring to?
That's in the Midrashic texts of the Messianic legend.
Hmm. Interesting. Thank you. I'll follow up on your comment in a second also. Yeah.
One other thing is, which I perhaps you've already done, is it's as an Ashkenazi Jew, I'm limited by my heritage and upbringing, but my understanding has been that Joseph is a far bigger heroic picture in the Persian Jewish community, which Los Angeles has now embraced and been so I just as the Messianic myths can read back on this concept. I don't know what the Persian stories do.
That's interesting. So in contemporary Persian circles, yeah,
right.
That's really interesting. So Joseph definitely retains real currency certainly the Joseph and Asnat story, the Hellenistic story of Joseph and Asnat that sort of fleshes out the relationship and the story that isn't a story that is mentioned in Genesis 41 suggests that people continued to be interested in Joseph. I just heard a great paper by Andrew Teeter, where he identifies parallels in Jeremiah that are drawn between Jeremiah and Joseph in three chapters of the book of Jeremiah that are definitely late, and I think are actually, there's a kind of boomerang effect going on in some of the details in the Joseph story, in Genesis 47 in particular, I think after hearing Andrew Teeter's paper, I have a better sense of where this late stuff is coming from in the Joseph story. So this idea of Joseph as this kind of standalone figure who was a hero in Egypt and becomes a symbol, I think, of imperial of reversal of imperial domination does retain currency. And I think there's probably a lot more to his character than we can get from the way it's been folded into the Jacob story in the Bible. Yeah.
To look at some of the darker side of Joseph, especially the way he was treating the Egyptians during the lean years, taking all their animals, their possessions, stripping them until they had nothing left. Does this show us a kind of a diabolical side, or at the most, without loving kindness?
I think that Joseph, I think, is different from the Joseph of either Joseph the Hebrew, who is a hero who saves Egypt through his wisdom and foresight, and also is different from the Joseph, the sort of naive dreamer that we meet in Genesis 37. And I think that the darker evil twin Joseph that we see in Genesis 47 does seem to me the best explanation that I can come up for it at this point is that he becomes this kind of model for resistance to imperialism. So in the same way that the book of Esther ends with, you know, massacre, that there's this kind of trend within late biblical texts to represent Jews as in a position of opposition and resistance and power over imperial forces. And I don't know, that's... Yeah.
The Quran greatly elaborates the Joseph story. Have you, especially the seduction of Potiphar's wife.
Yeah, that's right.
Have you any idea why, perhaps in your studies, have you found what were the Quranic authors trying to do?
Yeah, I it's something that I'm interested in, but I haven't pursued at all. It's an interesting question. I mean, again, I think that Joseph is this incredibly compelling figure, right? He's an incredibly compelling figure for all sorts of reasons. But I don't know anything about the context in which the Quranic narratives took their shape. Sorry. Yeah.
You've talked about the development of the text. I'm wondering to what extent you think the development of the text is a reflection of actual developments on the ground in the settlement of the highlands and beyond.
So I do. I think that when I first noticed what I think is this early Joseph the Hebrew story in 39 to 41, the question that it raised was, whose ancestor was he, right? If you have this guy who's not the son, one of the sons of Jacob, and Jacob is Israel, right, then why would biblical authors need to compose a story of Jacob as Israel that's rooted in a story of somebody else who, and so I guess I do see the incorporation of the Joseph the Hebrew tradition into the larger Joseph ben Jacob's story as reflecting a real shift in, I mean, again, this comes back to what is the relationship between the Beit Yosef and Israel? And that's something that I don't feel like I have enough of a handle on yet. But whoever's writing the Jacob story, the story of Jacob and his sons, understands Joseph to be essential to Israel, to what it is to be Israel. Otherwise, there would be no reason to use that story as the way to create this, you know, the sort of origin story for Israel. So I do see the evolution of the Joseph story as reflecting an evolution in the in what it means to be Israel. But exactly how that's playing out, I still need to give some thought to, especially where this issue of what is the relationship between Israel and the Beit Yosef. I think this idea of Israel as the thing that's ruled, it probably has some merit. And But again, I don't know yet. But I think the answer to your question is yes.
Well, thank you for a very stimulating lecture.
Thank you.